Hello, I'm Jeremy Rivera, your unscripted SEO podcast host. I'm here with Chris Green of Torque Partnership. And go ahead and introduce both yourself and your brand through the lens of why we should trust you.
Why we should trust me? Good question. I've been doing SEO for about 15 years, maybe longer now. So have seen a lot, learned a lot. Across quite a few different seats. So started off in technical and content and then moved through to running teams, managing teams, got more into the data analytics side. And now today, you're more likely to see me helping run global programs for SEO, GEO, measurement, AI search, whatever that seems to be. I am a senior consultant for large brands, Fortune 500s, that kind of thing, trying to wrangle this stuff and ultimately make it understandable and accessible to as much of the org as possible, which is a very different skill set to being an agency SEO, I can tell you. So yeah, trust me, I've done it for a while.
Let's take it from a technical point of view. I want to touch on some of the older patents that we've had knowledge about in Google and kind of touch on them. Because in the past, you know, with Bill Slosky and his seminal work and analysis, they really felt like anchors to the SEO ecosystem. You know, everybody would fly high on this tangent or that of like the tactic du jour, but there was kind of a grounding of these things. I'm wondering, you know, how accurate those touch points still are. So, you know, if we talked about, start with like the mechanics of how equity enters a site and moves between pages, you know, through the PageRank mechanism.
Yep.
What is your take on how that still functions today?
I would say for me, the tricky part with PageRank or any others is we know when the patent comes in. We know when it's established. We don't often have a consistent, concrete understanding of for how long that mechanism is at work or what other systems intertwine with it. Occasionally, we get snips of information that might validate the mention of a patent or a technology that makes it feel more relevant or not. But for me, like coming back to the PageRank example, I think at a point of principle, it's still important, but I would say it's very easy to overthink or overly kind of craft your decision-making based on that. So if you were simulating PageRank to say, right, if I add this linking module, how does it impact PageRank distribution? You can do that. That is a good a way of visualizing the potential impacts of how equity is sent through a site. But if you were going to hedge a decision or a do I roll this out, don't I, on that kind of analysis, for me, that's the risk, because we don't know how that system intersects with other systems, how authorities spread, and in the kind of detailed way with all of the other layers. So I would say learn them, be aware of them, be conscious of them. I think that's what Bill's work did for many of us, is just you didn't have to read necessarily, assimilate and understand the entire patent to understand where things might impact you. And I think if you can kind of understand the principle of PageRank flow, you can kind of understand, well, how do other systems maybe work? How would I, if this is my base, where do I then go from here? But I see a lot of people, I mean, I'm based in the UK, but I see a lot of people, particularly in kind of Europe, France, that side of the side, that they often keep very, very close to this. Very smart people, kind of very backed, a lot more in sort of academia and sometimes information retrieval, but will often over-index on these things. It's kind of like, well, I proved this patent proves this to be true, therefore I'm going to keep doing it. And for me, one of the hardest parts on SEO, one of the most important, is, well, how do we test it? Because no one's going to tell us to what degree that patent's still in effect, how much impact it has, or whether it connects with something else. So how do we follow that chain from academic side to this is how it impacts? Because you might be able to impact PageRank flow, but that might then not impact overall visibility, which, what are we trying to do? Are we engaging with the core kind of mechanics, or actually are we trying to make a result? So I think if you know how to test it and you know how to be skeptical, then it's still valuable, still highly valuable.
So next would be thinking about reasonable surfer. Are surfers reasonable? And when half of our surfers are now bots, or actually, I think it's greater than half, more than half of web traffic is now bots. Do the same rules apply? And since bots have their own system of arriving at the page and aren't going through Google's recorded user stat, you know, they're not pogoing back like normal Google users are, does it matter if they just arrive directly on the page?
This is a tricky, I think for me, a lot of this hinges on our value to be able to identify a bot from a human or more to the point, an agent doing a task on our behalf. I think, fundamentally, I think it turns it on its head. Like I've watched agent behavior quite a lot. Even whether it's, using Puppeteer or Chromium or something to simulate user, or whether it's just kind of, acting in a slightly more kind of bot like fashion, I suppose. And the behavior is frankly totally different. And certainly from when it does engage with analytics data that I've seen, it looks totally different as well. So it's kind of like user behavior collapses, like things like dwell time where you click, frustration points, call to actions, everything like that is sort of turned on its head. So how Google detects it, whether it be, you know, patterns in the user agent, different conditions on how it connects or other factors, I think for me has the biggest bearing on whether they need to change or reevaluate. Agents acting on behalf of humans changes a lot of things for a lot of people, I think. In a lot of ways that aren't ideal. I think that one of the things that I'm constantly trying is reliable ways to get agents to fire analytics, but with some kind of appraisal mechanism, say this is a bot, this is likely a bot, because it pollutes all of my other data, which then ruins decision making, which then eventually potentially ruins my budget and my remit. So I've kind of sidestepped that question and say I think it's a fundamental problem for everybody, like agent, particularly the ones that operate through your own user agent. So it kind of it's using your session or your browser data, your device data, and it's acting on your behalf. I mean, we come down to good old sort of bot mitigation and CDN like security style methods of detecting, which is resource intensive and done at a different point in the stack. So tricky one. I mean, it changes a lot. We can't assume the behavior is changing. If people are transacting through agents more, they're a key audience, they're a key user. Any assumptions that we make about the importance of a page that's polluted by that data is long, long at risk.
Yeah, I'd seen on LinkedIn, I think it was Gary Moeller or one of the other friendly faces at Google saying, hey, you know, it's markdown's not a thing that you should consider adding to your page, was their statement. But the response to that was, okay, you say that, but you're also extremely resource, intensive at Google. And the reality is that it takes three times as long to resolve, you know, HTML versus a markdown file for these agents. It's much more intensive for them to do that. So while, you know, Patrick Stocks, I think, said, hey, it was Dan Kurtz, my last interview. He said, you know, agents and bots are now just another audience. So if they like Markdown, or you want to give them an option to process it and give them an easier pathway and a handshake system that can optimize and have that, let them chat in their bot language much faster than humans, go ahead and do that. Just don't cloak it, but embrace the, you know, additional potential audience.
The lingering worry I have about, well, we're talking about layers, aren't we? Like audience layers. So like the human layer, the bot layer.
Should you, like, you know, do you take the time to create a markdown version of the page and link it somewhere in the page? Or do you add a markdown callout in your alt text, in your meta text of the page to make it available to bots to process or other? Just kind of the existence of it, yeah, and kind of playing around with, hey, if we recognize that, you know, efficiency often leads, it's like water. You know, when you have a more efficient option, there's a tendency to flow towards it. So there's, you know, other factors that resist it, you know, and if Google's a big player and is resisting, you know, endorsing markdown coming up everywhere, largely because they just don't want to have a second page, two pages to have to process. But that's more of their own walled garden. But for a owner of a site, you know, like I could ask Claude to add a markdown file to all my pages and have it done in, you know, half an hour at most.
It's, I think for a lot of the sites I work on, so there's a couple of elements to this. I think there's the technical side and then there's the kind of the ideological side. I feel like Google's resistance is a little bit technical and ideological. It's kind of, firstly, trust issues. Like, why would we trust this markdown file if we can't verify it against the HTML version? And if we verified it against the HTML, why do we need the markdown? I think that whole process needs to be resolved. And I think as long as I frankly, they have no reason to believe SEOs at large, because if I'm being also honest, I think the industry on the whole has not given them a reason to trust too much. Broadly, but I think from my side of things, like looking at that, so a lot of my clients are on stacks that are quite complicated, multiple CMSs, multiple iterations, technical debt, various other bits. And the adding that new, like that mark, say that markdown layer, or then the agentic kind of communication layer, and then in any other like ancillary feeds and stuff, presents kind of a challenge of how do you maintain like a level of consistency across all layers. So a relatively small static site that's built in a predictable way, or not even static, sorry, like a, I don't know, like a WordPress or something, that's fairly simple. Like as long as you've not butchered the theme, as long as your fields are consistent, like it's almost a non-task. You can kind of do it automatically and never think about it again. Mm-hmm. And I think if that's you and you can do it now, I can think of no reason why you wouldn't, because...
Right.
At runtime, like inference time, that stuff's useful to agents. So let's do it. Kind of don't worry about what Google's saying.
Yeah.
For a 50,000, 100,000, million page website that's like made with like duct tape and sticky tape and other things, it's just not going to fly. I think how the org manages it, what happens if your markdown versions are serving different content to your HTML ones, that's different content from your feeds, and how do each team, is it one team that manages it, is it free? And I think the more you layer onto that, the more logistically that becomes a nightmare, and we end up at a route where a markdown file serving different data, no one's going to tell you at the moment. There isn't a single bot or service out there that will say, hey, your markdown file's 404ing. And I think we kind of rely a little bit on Google and to an extent like Bing and similar to provide us that. So for me, it's a maintenance overhead versus the benefit. Like, are we convinced it's worth doing if it's a really tricky thing? And on the slightly more kind of cutting edge side of things, you could deploy that via the edge. So if you use a CDN like Akamai or Fastly or Cloudflare, maybe that network will automatically like mark down your website and serve it at a different content type. Like all of that's possible and relatively straightforward, but even those automated processes are not foolproof. I've seen it getting it wrong quite recently. So there's a certain fragility or difficulty around it, and currently a lack of proof that it pays off. I'm not definitely saying no, don't do it. But it's at that time where more people need to test it. They need to be bold, but then they also need to be confident enough to share the answers as well. It's kind of like the Wild West in a very small niche and overly techie kind of way.
It occurs to me, you know, I came up with my conversation with Timothy Jackson. He's doing agentic AI consulting, and he brought up that there's already, you know, millions of dollars of transactions from bots that have been given access to wallets who are seeking other bots to make transactions happen. And largely, you know, on e-commerce side, but he said, you know, watch this space in the next year or two, where you're going to see things like restaurant inventory is going to be an inventory task where, you know, as people pull stuff off shelves, they'll, you know, flash it at an IR and it'll get added. And then when they run out of grapes, when they run out of butter, it'll agentically, the handshake bot will find and order the lowest price butter within the approved vendors. If that's occurring, if that's in the stack of things that we need to start optimizing for, then does Markdown, is that still an auxiliary task? If we know now that these bots are running around with money falling out of their pockets?
I mean, from an agentic point of view, I think there's a possibility that will work well. The biggest issue we've got right now, I feel, is which protocol or which standard do we hedge? So, because I think at the moment, it's kind of a do as much of it as you possibly can and hope you've backed the right horse. I think fundamentally, I think if you're a website owner right now that has a very online, very technical audience, early adopters, and then you decide to host your own Markdown version of all your content or put all your documentation in Markdown, I absolutely would. Because I think to that extent, if you run an agent locally, if you have Claude Code or Cursor or anything like that, and you give it the same task twice, one task is go check on this website, or the other variant is go check this directory where I've got all of the Markdown. It will do it more efficiently with a directory full of Markdown than it will if it has to go and fetch it. So I think, and that's where a lot of the resistance has come to people saying, no, don't Markdown. I think it is clear that that route is, there's some efficiencies in it. It's just comes into contact with reality. And a lot of these kind of like monolithic companies that need to work with it are, they probably don't have the budget to do the everything mode, maybe except for Cloudflare. Cloudflare pressed the everything button a year ago, and they're just like, I mean, if I'm being frank, they're spamming us now. It's just, what do we do? Another technical standard. Great. Thanks, Cloudflare. Put it on the list.
Going back to Reasonable Surfer, it occurs to me that, you know, I kind of mangled a little bit of the actual application of the patent, because the patent was really about how to value the placement of links in a page. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, you know, is a subset of like, hey, the audience coming to it and the behavior. I'm curious then what your input is on, you know, do we still pay it? Do the Reasonable Surfer link placement rules still apply? But then that opens a conversation overall about how do we consider links when, you know, we're, you know, AI overviews, ChatGPT, yeah, Perplexity. To what degree does standard link building, I guess, or traditional link building, if you'll call it that, you know, when is the watershed moment where it doesn't hold as much value? Or is it actually the reverse? Is it, as you know, more people are just seeing, you know, oh, mentions work just as well, I'll just get a bunch of mentions. Yeah. And those that know this long that it is to get actual links still do the hard work to get it done, might get more value out of that.
Yeah. There's a lot to that one. I think the part of it that's simpler or easier to kind of align to is the principle behind what Reasonable Surfer was trying to achieve, in that some links are just more important because they're going to be more useful than others. I'm kind of grossly oversimplifying,
yeah,
but
that's good.
I think that tracks to what we should possibly be aiming for, or one of the steering points. I mean, obviously what that then completely misses is as we said right at the start, that kind of the agent or the technical kind of audience member in that. On the value of link building and whether we have that watershed moment, I think we are going through one now, in the sense of a lot of the tactics that we'd kind of written off as less effective, ineffective, or totally totally unworkable are kind of coming back, but in slightly new, different geo-wrapped guises. Like the value of the link, you know, being mentioned more times in the right ways can help from like a training data point of view, brand strength, brand affinity, kind of topicality, etc. That stuff is all really important. For me, on that side of things, I'd say it's quite challenging to understand exactly the value you get out of it. Just because training data moves so slowly, data refreshes take a long time. We, to be frank, don't really know what's going on under the hood. I think I know very clearly that a brand that's got a very strong brand does very well. But that's not a shocking finding. I mean, that kind of proves that the system's broadly on the right track to want. I'd say the search, the RAG part of the process is more ripe for gaming right now. And you're kind of stuck in a position there where, as long as you're not doing something that gets you completely kicked out of search, if you're still returned by the search infrastructure that underpins Gemini or Claude or ChatGPT, then it could be quite beneficial. Like some of these old link building techniques can still be far more effective. And I say, like the consensus building that ChatGPT does, for example, it's over reliance on Reddit articles, or even the fact anecdotally, like certain page types that weren't super valuable for traditional search are actually really, really valuable from a retrieval side. So
yeah,
I think it's happening. I don't have an ebook to package it up as or a course to sell on LinkedIn about it yet, because to be frank, every time I find a trend or something that seems to stick, It rotates out super quickly. I guess the easy one to pick for that is, we're going slightly on tangent, but it's that whole kind of like listicle type, that kind of content type that is still frankly doing well. And I think that will continue to for some time, because it's kind of like the perfect way to, I guess, fool the system. The AI side of the search equation has not got a proper handle on quality yet. You know, what is ChatGPT's equivalent to Reasonable Surfer? Right now, they're kind of relying on what's returned via their search sources to help that.
Yeah.
But that's not perfect. There is a quality issue there. So Gemini will be the strongest because it's kind of closest to Google. But then even saying that, it's definitely not perfect. A long story short and a bit of a ramble, Lisa, I'm not really sure. I think for me, I'd use the guiding principle of, you know, Reasonable Surfer is a good way, helps us know what Google wants to see a website being built like, and whether the machines or not are moving in that direction, time will tell.
With everything shifting, give us a tactical win that you're spamming that button, because it's just like, duh, this works. It has always worked. It's going to keep working.
This one's going to sound really boring, I guess, or trite, but it being explicit about what you provide and why it's valuable has always been super effective. There's an if and a but to that. Like, you need to have some kind of recognition and value in the space beyond that. Like, if you were a brand new business today and you just laid it all out, this is what I do and it's great, you're not going to see instant success. Obviously, the world doesn't work like that. But if I look back to like working with brands or anyone who spent any kind of money on being a recognizable brand, the quickest win they can ever make is just be clearer, abandon fluffy kind of rhetoric, be distinct, you know, make actual statements, and, you know, avoid overuse of metaphor or superlatives. And it's just, some of it is just writing kind of persuasively and succinctly, and that's always worked. Okay, whether that's at the top of a 1200 word article or whether it's now part of a bullet point list or an FAQ module, or that the content formats have tended to change, but there's still a degree of make it explicit. I was speaking with a client a few days ago, and their biggest issue was, well, they just weren't getting found for a certain kind of service that they're offering. And you look at the pages and this service is inferred.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, I mean, their customers were, they were very kind of low numbers, but sort of typically high value, but still the kind of the feedback to them was, well, we need to make it explicit to an agent or a bot or ChatGPT or whomever to return that results. It's like, that's the simplest thing we can do. We don't need to spend a lot of money. We don't need to change a lot of content. Just somewhere on the page, just put a call to action, say that you offer this service and drive them to contact. And yeah, sometimes it's not always super complex or difficult. The other one that I'm finding more now, and I know it's not the one I'm hitting spam on, but I'm seeing more and more, and it's coming back to that kind of consensus building. I'd say in SEO previously, we'd be very much like either very defined content structures or try not to mix your concepts or put concepts in too many places. And actually, I've gone back to some sites or content areas that are very mixed and they're very spread. And what I'm seeing in indications is actually sometimes it's making you more likely to have those linked citations retrieved, because I think I'd ran some of the numbers from, albeit just a relatively isolated kind of client test, but if you had 3 to 4 links that were selectable, you were much more likely to get included in the citation than if you had under 3, or interestingly over that 4 or 5 mark. There seemed to be like this sweet spot where just having a number of like really compelling entries to select from just increased your chances. It's not exhaustive. I don't think it sets the world on fire, but the way that we're working with that is to say, well, yeah, you need to not have that information on that subdomain. You need to put that information on your main domain, but leave it on the subdomain as well. Link it up. It's not move one, it's keep one and the other, and just that's the direction we're going down from an experimentation point of view, because we just want as many, when ChatGPT shuffles its search results back into its kind of answer it's generating, we just want to increase the likelihood that ours is the selected one. And that seems to be one of the factors that plays quite highly.
So, in other words, meat's back on the menu, boys. Let's get cannibalistic. I mean, because that's...
Yeah,
right?
Because
that yeah. was why we had that intent narrowing. Yep. We're like, oh, we don't yep. want to cannibalize this. We got to separate and individualize and only return these specific things. But
yeah,
you're right that there's a flip side to like the randomness, the non-repeatability factor. If you're trying to get more entries across the query fan out, then to get more bites at the apple is the objective versus, you know, getting the biggest bite out of the apple at one time, with, yeah. like Google's.
Yeah, because then once it's got the bites, it's got the links, it's then matching you against the initial query, and you're kind of how closely related those concepts are. So more chances is better than fewer. The however and the if, and I've had this in other areas, is we don't want to over push, because right now, attributable clicks-wise, Google is still driving more than any AI chatbot, so you don't want to shoot yourself in the foot. But yes. And there is a possibility that we as an industry may have got a little oversensitive to cannibalization in a very kind of strict kind of way. And there's always the potential that it maybe wasn't the biggest issue. So we could have been overzealous, I guess, on that.
I think it's just an easy thing to, you know, program your tools to discover. Oh, you're cannibalizing.
Yeah. And your juniors.
Yeah. It's, you know, oh, hey, you're ranking 2 pages for the same term. How dare you get twice as many eyeballs, get 2 different query sets for the same term? Always kind of conflicted in my head. I haven't, you know, ever fully committed to like decannibalizing any particular site. So for me, it's an easy win there of like, oh, maybe. But yeah, it is that sweet spot moment of like, how far do we push things in our optimization stack for the new side of these? But also it's a good time to challenge our presumptions. You know, there are people 100%. Who lived and died by cannibalism or anti-cannibalism, but I never saw too strong. I saw 1 or 2 anecdotes. It seemed okay, but I was never fully convinced.
Yeah. And I think that this kind of balancing act on like, how do we work with one without tipping over the other is a really kind of key one. I've had another recent test come in where it looks like we've made like the initial content more like fit for AI in that sense. Not changing it dramatically, just reformulating it and positioning it. And it's definitely driven stronger visibility in the AI searches for the prompts that we've set up to track. But early signs are from like an impressions point of view via Google, it's not tracking in the same direction. Now, it's not necessarily say that we think that this impact has hurt SEO at the benefit of AI search. Like, it's far too early to suggest that. But if that was the end result, it would be an interesting one, but a conflicting one. We don't have an operation model when GEO and AEO work at a different focus to SEO. Like, there's lots of people trying, and there's got kind of sort of tribal almost and kind of aggressive online. Like, a lot of people just out of point of principle either do or don't like SEO. But I think there's in some organizations working with right now, we've had that conversation, like, what happens if, from a governance accountability point of view, if they're two separate entities, you've got SEO over here and GEO over there, like, how does one stop the other one from kind of detrimenting? And previously, the biggest issue SEOs would probably worry about is paid search or bidding on our brand terms again, therefore dropping our brand traffic. And I don't know many organizations that have solved that over the long term, because PMax and AI bidding is making that worse again, in my experience. So yeah, it's just another source of, like, we're warring with another kind of channel set that actually is probably, like, still our own channel, but we just haven't agreed on that fully.
It is. I've changed my mindset. I used to think that there was SEO and it overlapped in a Venn diagram on part of it. But I've changed my mindset. I think that everything within SEO is in the middle, and AI and GEO and AI SEO all overlays on the top of it because it overlaps in so many other disciplines. And, you know, crosses over to PR work, especially, you know, how they process mentions and how you can better acquire mentions is way, way more of a PR play or a smart, savvy link building play. If you were, you know, doing a really good job, you know, in 2010, you were doing the same things. Like, Rand Fishkin talked about unlinked mentions, what, 2012 was the first time that it came up. And, you know, the amount of zero clicks has just increased. Now we're just adding a whole nother surface layer and competitors that are, you know, causing more zero click in the system. What's your stack look like or process when it comes to attribution? You know, how do you claim this space as an SEO? You know, behind the scenes, do you stage yourself as more of a connector? Are you, you know, more hand in glove with other departments and teams? Like, you know, how do you prove your value and worth to C-suite or get that, you know, if you're a freelancer, how are you landing that retainer if, you know, we're getting the squeeze, if you will?
So, I guess the easiest one for everyone to sort of gather around to start with is having your brand mentioned in a chatbot response is better than not as an entry point, which again is simple, but it's a case of, well, sometimes the being mentioned and the being visible there is the only sign that it's working, or, you know, because the actual directly attributable clicks, traffic, revenue, what have you, is likely to be underreported or stolen from another channel. It will come through direct, or it will come through some other kind of thing. And it's, and I think most people that have some kind of buy-in around the value of mentions and brand, much more traditional kind of marketing metrics, that works as a starting point. For me, I've always been more of in the technical marketing side of things. I'm not afraid of analytics, platforms, databases, log file analyses, that kind of thing. And for me, one of the other treasure troves of information is access logs. So if we can say, like, these AI bots are visiting on these days, you know, here's your average count for the amount of times that, you know, a user-driven bot has appeared versus a training bot versus a search bot, etc. You can start to build this picture that you can add sort of proxies or leading indicators to success. And in my experience, very few people are bringing that kind of value. I mean, a lot of the big tool vendors are trying to right now, but trying to land that as an external tool vendor is difficult. it just your positioning's not strong there, to be honest with you. Beyond that, though, I'd say it's a little bit of a fight that's very much organization dependent. So if you're in e-commerce, sort of teams and work streams that were parallel, so shopping feed managers, paid search channels, you know, whether we're talking about Meta or TikTok or other shopping platforms, every single tool that works in that space is now claiming to be an AI tool. And then inevitably everyone's adding generative features like writing generative copy, doing this, that, and the other. And I think we're going to see a really big convergence of all of these channel paths, because fundamentally, when in e-commerce, if you're optimizing a shopping feed, do you really need an SEO, a paid search manager, a social media manager, like all of these different people that we've put in? Do you need absolutely all of them in that mix? And I don't have the clear deciding view on that. But the part that's come back the most often is, and this is where I kind of fall back to, and it usually works, is, do you still want a search engine to rank you well for this? Doesn't have to just be Google, could be an internal search in Amazon, it could be anything like this. Like, if the answer to that is yes, you need keywords, you need the idea around user intent, and you need the ability to optimize content. And even the smartest AI systems that people are rolling out into these various platforms, they still need to be grounded on that data, that keyword data. So, you know, you kind of work the way down that road. In big organizations, where do you get that information from? Who has that knowledge? In an effective sense, like anyone can pick keywords, but who can pick the right keywords with the right and match it to the intent and understand it? And that's still where I think SEOs have the biggest kind of cause there. The other factor is SEOs are nosy and yeah, don't like staying in their lane. So you mentioned PR just then, you could kind of talk about link building. I kind of go off and find the team that runs the data warehouse. I'll go and see, can we start ingesting this data sources? Can I start matching it? And for me, I think if you can do that, when attribution becomes more solidified, you know, when GSC starts returning better data or ChatGPT starts giving impression data to paid, like when we start getting more insights, if you've invested in your data infrastructure point, you're at that fulcrum of, you can start piecing it together. And the minute you can do that, you can be landing knowledge bombs on people's desks that no one else can. So I think prove you can optimize the feeds and that you know what the feeds and the data sources are.
Yeah.
And then double down on how you report and tell people your success. And then for me, that's how I'm doing it. And I'm still very busy, so it's obviously working to some extent.
Here's something you touched on with log files. Is there a prompt you're using in your AI tools to kind of help process or surface value out of that? Or do you use a tool set to process log files? I'm about to try to get log files for a couple of my projects. I had worked on some larger e-commerce and mm-hmm. some larger enterprise level customers who had a Botify account or a couple others that had such a large volume of content that they started to pay attention to log files. So mm-hmm. I'm in principle, I'm generally familiar with some of the indications, but it occurs to me the way I was doing it before is really dumb when I have tools at my fingertips that can process data 10 times faster than I can. It's just if you know what some of those prompts are that can deliver something of value, and if you'd stumbled on them or trial them.
So I think a lot of it depends on when or what. What's the analysis you're doing at that point? I think if you're, so it's at a simple level, some of the things will just be what was, you know, take an average of like bot hits to a segment of pages. So segment your content first, and then just how has that changed over time? Say you run like a split test. So you say, I've updated some pages and not others. Segment those pages, take a grab of your log files at a certain date, and then compare it. And I think that's at an entry level, that's probably one of the most simple things you can do. I think the exact prompts and how you do it depends on where the logs are stored and how you're going to be interrogating that data and the volume of the logs. Log files can be enormous. So to the point where you need to use like a log file analysis tool or a tool like Splunk, or you need to push it into a database and use BigQuery or SQL or to query it. And I think how you get the most out of Claude to help you depends on the platform and how you do it. The thing I'm reluctant to do so at the moment, and that often depends on like my MSAs and my security like arrangements and stuff, is giving direct access to your data. Like it, some of my clients, I can't do. Some I can only do within a certain environment. And again, that certainly does impact it. But I would say, if you can get the data into BigQuery, you can query it actually using Data Studio, for example. You can kind of use Data Studio as like a front end. Mm-hmm. Obviously it costs, you have to pay data processing. And as long as you know what you're looking for, you can actually do some of that work without and reduce a lot of that level of complexity. To be honest, if it is in BigQuery and you know what all the fields are called, you could say to you know to Claude, hey Claude, these are my fields. I want to segment my pages on this regex, and then I want to understand what my running average for bot hits are. I want to find who my outliers are. Like, help me write a SQL query that can help identify that. For example, like that can work. It takes a bit of experimentation. Anything analyst wise though, if you kind of know how you would do it without Claude, you can get Claude to do it much more effectively for you, because you know what to ask and what to look out for. It's very, very easy to start hallucinating things, or it might start seeing a trend in the data that's not really there. And depending on your log format, you could have a lot of data in there that's just noise. For example, if you just said, tell me all of my ChatGPT bot hits, that's not the user agent, I've forgotten it, but is it a valid ChatGPT hit, or is it someone that's spoofing it? And without telling Claude to check the IP range and the other network conditions, you may start analyzing bot activity on the wrong bot. It could just be a spoofer.
ChatGPT, isn't there like two different bots based off the behavior?
I think there's three now. I think there might even be more. There's user, search, and then training for ChatGPT. I say that with confidence. It changes all the time. I could actually be wrong by now. Google are the least helpful with how they designate AI bots, which is, I mean, that you can tell they've done it for a while, because if I was Google, I'd do the same. to be honest with you, you know, don't hate the player, hate the game to an extent. But yeah, ChatGPT is quite useful. That Perplexity and Claude, I think Anthropic, do some fairly good detailed levels. So you can at least understand, is this bot just crawling for training data, or is this bot acting on the user's behalf? And, you know, acting on the user's behalf is a proxy for visibility, or being surfaced at least by an AI tool. And for me, that's like the most valuable thing to get out of that. So we've made some changes over this 6 months to strengthen your AI search, and the average daily visits from the user triggered AI bots has gone up. That's not attachable to revenue, but you can say, well, this correlates with our involvement. We are making your site more findable potentially. Like, and that's a good thing to ground yourself on. If all of the other metrics you have will be share of voice or visibility, and they'll be based on prompt tracking, and then it gets horribly complex and easy to argue about.
Let's kind of wrap up here. Tell us about a Torque partnership. Tell us a little bit more about Chris Green, what you're doing. If people want to know more about your work, how you can help them, if you've put out anything interesting, any research.
Cool. So Torque partnership is a consulting business. We work mostly in tech, CDN, SEO, specialize in like global programs for SEO, complex developments, troubleshooting, that kind of thing. I get to work with some really smart people doing some really cool stuff. So I'm kind of happy that kind of is ticks all the boxes there. From my point of view, I am on LinkedIn, Substack, Blue Sky, etc. Just look for Chris Green SEO. I've started publishing a lot more work on Substack recently, trying to post stuff that's useful. And I'm kind of trying to adopting the learning in public kind of methodology around this. Is kind of like, in particular, digging into ChatGPT search functionality, what I think we need to change from metrics, how we might map different like agentic standards against real world applications. So yeah, stop by and say hi. When people reach out and say, hey, I've read your work, could you change this? Or just, it's been useful. That makes my day. So yeah, it doesn't take many of those, but I'll keep sharing my stuff on there, whether people do that or not. This is a super, super interesting time to research. And it couldn't have come at a better time, because I was kind of getting a little bit bored of talking about canonical tags and headings, if I'm honest. It's nice to be challenged again.
It's funny because the most comfortable time, I think, was 2010 to 2020, where there was such a heavy monopoly on Google that it almost became boring because, you know, like, here's an algorithm update that doesn't really impact anything unless you're doing casino spam. Like the technical SEO challenges were rather minimal, you know, unless you're like super at scale. But then at scale, it's really just red tape navigation. You know, 3/4 of enterprise SEO is just cutting through red tape and figuring out how to wait your turn for dev resources to get things deployed correctly the first time. But I greatly appreciate your perspective talking about some of the more esoteric aspects of SEO. So I'll make sure that your Substack is linked in the show notes and your profile anybody can connect with. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
For my listeners, there's going to be a detailed breakdown of this conversation on unscriptedseo.com. I've got other fantastic interviews for you to check out with other SEOs in the library. Check it out, unscriptedseo.com.